This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. You know, one question that we history guys get a lot is, how come there aren't any history gals with you in the studio? And that's a perfectly good question. In fact, it's such a good question that it's way above my pay grade. But I will say that 40 years ago, nobody would have asked that question. And that's because 40 years ago, history departments were mainly made up of guys. And more importantly, and probably not surprisingly, those guys were mainly writing about other guys. In fact, history consisted of guys with women making bit appearances as wives of people who were really making history.
Out of the 60s came a new generation of scholars determined to change that. Among them, an early American historian named Linda Kerber. She pored over the historical record and set out to tell a different story about the role of women in the founding period.
So I was kind of mucking around, trying to fit these pieces together, and I came upon this commencement address at Columbia College in 1795, in which this young man is speaking in these rather romantic, rotund phrases about the future of the Republic, and he turns to the women, and he says, "You fair ones, the future of the world is in your hands."
Yes, ye fair, the reformation of a world is in your power. Contemplate the rising glory of Confederated America. Consider that your exertions can best secure, increase, and perpetuate it. The solidity and stability of the liberties of your country rest with you, since liberty is never sure till virtue reigns triumphant.
Then I started noticing where, in other places that I read, people talking to women, be careful who you marry. Marry men who are virtuous. Marry men who will be good citizens. And then together you will raise, you know, the next generation of good citizens for the new republic.
The idea that women could do something more than just sit back and watch history happen, Kerber began to see, was not a new idea. It was present all the way back to the 1790s. Sure, they couldn't run for office or vote or own much property, but what they could do was key to the success of the new nation, and that was to raise good citizens. This new role for women, Kerber came up with the name for it, Republican motherhood. That's Republican with a small r. To her, it was a progressive ideal. After all, if women were responsible for raising good, moral citizens, they were going to have access to a good education themselves. But that was only half the story.
The contrast, the severe contrast, is when you hold this view of the world and where women fit in it against the legal system that the founding generation inherited from England and did not touch, which at bottom were the laws of master and servant. Americans make them worse. They add a layer of master and slave down at the bottom. They work up to master and servant, parent and child, and at the top is husband and wife. And in that law, the father controls all the property that the mother brings to the marriage and all her earnings during it. He controls all the earnings the child brings to the family. If the father wishes, for example, to apprentice a child to someone the mother thinks is a cruel master, the mother has no say in this. If the father wishes to pocket the child's earnings, the mother has no say in it.
So from the outset, from the very beginnings of our nation's history, we have this paradox. If you want to be a good citizen and you're a woman, the way to do it is by being a good wife and a good mother. But at the same time, there are all of these structures in place that limit your ability to do that.
And so in honor of Mother's Day, that's what we're going to be looking at for the rest of the hour today. Why has it been so difficult to be a good mother in a country that equates motherhood with, well, being American? And before you guys jump in, I'm going to suggest an answer. I think at least part of why it's been so difficult is because what it means to be a mother has constantly changed over time.
Oh, absolutely. And we can date this to a fairly short period in the late 18th century when motherhood was pretty much a function within a household economy. When the household and the farm or even an artisan shop is the center of production, mother, woman, wife has got a central role. And that is if a printer, for instance, dies, his wife may take over the print shop. So the gender roles are not constructed in the same way that they will be later on. They're not nearly as inflexible, and mothers were not necessarily primarily mothers.
You know, in the 19th century, what happens is not merely that women step into more restricted roles, but that they take on a new kind of role as the capitalist economy really speeds up. So you start having railroads and telegraphs and steam engines and the penny press and the growth of cities and westward expansion and all these things going on that people are familiar with. And what we forget is that that is a new way of living your life. And so it becomes clear that if an economy that has really very few rules and very few customary constraints is going to be the norm, you're going to have people who have internalized all the discipline and energy and anxiety that a capitalist economy feeds on.
Right.
So it becomes the woman's job, the mother's job, to raise these self-governing, self-motivating young people, especially young men, who can go out into the world and drive themselves, who can make it on their own, who can keep the capitalist economy humming.
So these moms are not only kind of the proto-citizen creator moms, they're the proto Harvard business schools of the 19th century. They're creating these men who are going to go out and act not only ethically, but in an autonomous way, be innovative.
Right.
And it's a lot more than citizenship.
And it seems to me that it's not merely the kids who are leaving the house, but in a real sense, it's the fathers who are leaving the house in a way they never have.
And the jobs are leaving the house.
Right. The jobs are leaving the house. You go to the job. So the absent father creates this kind of sentimental, emotional vacuum that mother dominates. It becomes mother's realm. The home is associated with mother in a way that the house never was.
Right.
Matter of fact, that phrase,
right?
What makes a house a home?
Exactly.
And the answer
is mom.
Mother.
Mom.
And we can actually see that emerge in the 1830s and 1840s.
Right.
It becomes codified. It comes written down. You really start seeing ladies' books, you know, magazines that are coming out that are celebrating this and telling you, here's what you have to do to be a good mother. And part of it's husbanding the resources, so to speak, of the household.
Nice.
But the other part of it is really focusing on the moral growth and well-being of your children. Mm-hmm. So it's not like on the farm, we'll take care of you for a while, then we'll hand the farm to you, then you'll take care of us and we'll die. But instead, you find that the bond, the contract, is almost ineffable. It's invisible, right? And think about the dominant kind of music of the 19th century, if it's not a minstrel show, is the sentimental song about leaving mom behind.
Yeah.
But when you leave home, what do you take? You take a piece of your mother with you.
She was gentle and so kind, and I'll ever bear in mind the many golden lessons she taught me. I have wealth and earthly power, yet I'd give all for 1 hour that I sat upon my dear old mother's knee.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about ideals of motherhood in American history. For the past few weeks, we've been fielding your comments on the topic at backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited a few of you commentators to join us on the phone. Peter, who's up first?
We have Barbara calling in from Fairfax, Virginia. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I believe that, you know, the whole theme here is about the history of motherhood in America. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what is motherhood in America? We're a country, first of all, we started out as a country of Native Americans, and then we brought in all these immigrant cultures, which definitely bring in different ways of mothering. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to hear, what's your definition of that?
Well, you're obviously right about the diversity of every kind of identity of class and space and time and ethnicity and all these different kinds of things. And it's interesting, however, that the common denominator, when you do think about what's as American as, and motherhood is one of the big things, why is that? It's because it's really one of the few things that we all have in common.
But then if we're all coming from different cultural backgrounds, what is it that's the American way of raising a child from the mother's perspective? Is there one?
Well, I think the American way, I would say from the beginning, is mothers are aware of the world around them, and their mothering strategies have to do with high rates of mobility, people moving all over the place, moving up and down the social ladder. So what's really important is a kind of child rearing that enables individuals as they grow up and leave home to function effectively. I mean, this is a familiar old argument, first made perhaps by Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America when he talks about individualism. The psychology and the idea of the individual, somebody who can go it alone, is something, of course, that doesn't come out of the air. It comes out of the home. And it's something that mothers teach their children.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, because, you know, when you look at, let's say, an Italian culture, families are very, they live together, the grandmother's there with the aunts and uncles and everything. In this country, largely because we were, you know, populating the country and moving out west and things, we pulled that whole family unit apart, so we did have to raise our children to be independent.
Now, I think something Barbara said strikes me as really true, and it kind of goes back to de Tocqueville, too. This is a lonely country. You know, you don't have all of the extended families because we've not really stayed in place long enough to become extended. And the nuclear family, that's often all the families have had, whether you're immigrants or moving to the West or you're enslaved. In each of these instances, you know, when I go back and read the diaries and letters of the women from the 19th century, there's just a longing for help and for families.
Yeah.
And I think that if there's a commonality about American motherhood compared to various old worlds from which people have come, mm-hmm. it might be the burden placed on mothers and all of this because of loneliness. What do you think, Barbara?
I think that's a great point, actually.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think I'm satisfied.
Well, thank you.
Right.
Thank
you for calling. Much.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I am Peter Onuf, and I speak for the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, and I speak for the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Ballow, voice of the 20th century. Today's topic, the history of motherhood in America.
A nice, small, manageable topic.
We're going to take another phone call now. It is Anne from our hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. Anne, welcome to Backstory.
Hi, thank you.
Well, we're talking about motherhood, and of course, we've all got one. So Anne, what's your question?
I guess I'm calling more on the trying to become a mother side of things.
Ooh, wow.
So I'm going to try to start getting pregnant next month, I guess.
And you're calling us for advice?
I know. Well, I was going to tell you a little story that leads up to my question.
Okay, good.
Which is that in the process of all this, I've started taking, you know, so many vitamins and supplements and so on that my my nephew thinks I'm going to live to be 100. But, you know, I've cut out caffeine, I've cut out alcohol, I've cut out sugar, and all this before, you know, I'm even trying to conceive. And I was having dinner with a friend of mine who's also a pediatrician the other night, and she said, you know, how is all this baby making going? Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I just hope I'm doing everything right. I just feel like I haven't done all the things I'm supposed to do yet.
Right.
You know, so she said, you know, it's important to do all the right things, sure. But I really see in this as a feminist an extension of, you know, this is her talking, an extension of the reproductive control of women. And that kind of, you know, it surprised me a little bit because I think I'm so lost in it at the moment. You know, it's I'm so focused on doing everything right because in my perspective, you know, I'm making another human from what I eat and what I do and who I already am.
First of all, Anne, I want to say on behalf of the Backstory team that we approve of everything you're doing. And it's just coincidental that we're all guys.
Right.
Right. what you're saying, what you're asking, Anne, is there a backstory to the regime or the circumstances under which modern would-be mothers operate, where they feel like they're carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders? And from a feminist perspective, that sounds like a male burden that has been inflicted on women. And, you know, I think that's right. And I will suggest why. And that is the ways in which men moved in the 19th century, not my century, but I'm moving in on Ed here, and he'll pick it up, I'm sure.
Go ahead.
Men moved in on childbirth, which had historically in early America, in my century, and well into the 19th century,
and
in many
millennia
areas of the country,
that.
Yeah, had been a female experience in which women would gather around, and it would often be an extended period, a kind of call it a festival or an extended moment of female solidarity. Men were excluded. This could go on for weeks with the laying in and then the first couple of weeks of recovering and adapting to the circumstances of motherhood. And the presiding genius in the birth experience would be a midwife.
And then in the 19th century, this was shunted aside in favor of male doctors.
Yeah.
Who then went back and pointed out that despite millennia of success, that it had been done all wrong. And it's interesting is that this was done not only by upper middle class white families in the Northeast, but slaveholders actually brought in male doctors to deliver babies to their enslaved women to make sure that the investment was protected. So if you wanted to, you know, actually make the case as thoroughly and discouragingly as possible, which I think maybe I've just done, that it began with control over the moment of birth, and then extended back, because the next episode you would have had in all this would have been after sort of the discovery of genetics. One of the first things that guys came up with is genetically improving the race and eugenics in the early 20th century, which would have been another way.
And it gets worse and worse.
It gets worse.
And don't hang up.
Oh, no, I'm right here. I love it.
And may I provide a somewhat happier spin that comes out of my century.
Yeah, that's the 20th century,
the happy century. In the late
Great.
1960s, we have, historians would call it second wave feminism, which emerges in the late 1960s and the 1970s. But out of that comes primers like Our Bodies, Ourselves, where women begin to take control back from these male doctors and take more responsibility for asking questions and, in fact, exploring scientific options. I think that's a semi-happy ending of the story. Here's the problem. I think it sets up your dilemma. It begins to place responsibility back with women themselves, and here we find you stressing out that maybe you're not doing something correctly.
You know, we focus so much on the birth process that we neglected to think about all the things that follow afterwards. And the great pressure then is not merely to birth a perfect child, but to be perfect every day until they get into the college of their choice.
You know, so, Anne, stop worrying about childbirth and
start worrying
and start
about,
about the rest
about
of your kind kid's
of,
life.
Middle school you're going to be able to
and
get
it's
this kid.
All up to you, Anne. No pressure, okay?
You know, my advice to you is stop taking advice. And now we're going to advise you on names for your child.
No, my advice to you would be to hang up. It's been really wonderful talking to you,
Thank
Anne.
You so much.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I turned 21 in prison doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better. But her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
If you're a new mother or a mother-to-be, and you're looking for some real advice, one place your Google searches might land you is mothering.com. That's the website of Mothering Magazine, which is a small publication that claims to be, quote, the birthplace of the natural family lifestyle. I happened upon it recently, and considering the magazine's small size, I was stunned by the amount of activity on its discussion forum. Since it launched 6 years ago, millions of comments have been posted there. Now, some contributors are more active than others, like, for example, Liz, the mother of an eight-month-old in Indianapolis. Liz, to say the least, is prolific. At last count, she was responsible for just under 19,000 comments. I asked her how she, as a new mother, could possibly find the time for all of those posts.
When you post a lot, you type faster. So where a lot of people are, you know, sitting there and some people
thinking about what they're going to say, you just post.
Yeah, exactly.
So give me an example of what somebody might learn from mothering.com.
Well, one forum that is particularly useful is the Gentle Discipline Forum, and it's a place where you discuss discipline techniques.
Sounds like they're not working so well.
Well, my husband's in charge now.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I found really useful is that on the website are a lot of people who have kids who are older than mine. They've been through it, many of them with more than one kid, three, four, five kids even.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I post, hey, my baby's doing this really weird thing, they can reply, that's totally normal. All my kids did that. Or, yeah, my kids did something like that, but it was more like this.
So you're kind of turning to a bunch of non-experts who have used their experience rather than some kind of scientific expertise to soothe your anxiety.
Yeah, because one of the issues people have is that a lot of these basic knowledge things don't come through. You know, if your mom, for instance, if your mom didn't breastfeed, you don't have her to give you that advice about breastfeeding. If your mom didn't do whatever it is, you don't have that advice.
Right.
But a lot of stuff on mothering is not just from their own experience, but stuff that they've also gone and looked at the scientific studies and research.
But they've kind of tested it. They've battle tested
mm-hmm,
it.
Exactly.
And so what this website does is it doesn't disregard the experts, but it kind of mediates that advice through the hard lessons learned from experience. Just one last question I have to know. Could you drop us a line here at backstoryradio.org when you hit the 20,000 mark?
Okay, will do.
Baby.
That was Liz, a mother in Indianapolis who gets by with a little help from her friends at mothering.com. You know, guys, this suggests that choosing between parenting advice from a book and parenting advice from a friend, well, today it might not be an either-or proposition. You know, Liz was suggesting that the internet allows us to blend the two. But that wasn't always the case. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, my century, guys, and they were all guys, with doctor in front of their name, and they all seemed to have doctor in front of their name, started telling mothers what they should do without any regard to centuries of mothering experience. That's because those guys with doctor in front of their name had science at their disposal. Here's the problem, that science was anything but definitive. Half the experts favored gentle nurturing, while the other half insisted on a stern, disciplined approach. One expert who fell squarely within the stern camp was John B. Watson, widely known as the father of behaviorism. What's behaviorism, you might ask? Well, it was pretty simple, really. It argued that everything we do could be conditioned by training. Watson is one of the experts profiled in Raising America, Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice About Children by Anne Holbert. Now, Watson only published one book about child rearing, but Anne Holbert told me that that book, Psychological Care of Infant and Child, made a huge splash when it was published in 1928.
A lot of mothers bought the book in the spirit of, you know, this guy seems to know what he's talking about. Let's see what he's got to say.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a little incredulous, which you can understand when you get just a little bit of the flavor of his rhetoric.
Won't you then remember when you are tempted to pet your child that mother love is a dangerous instrument? An instrument which may inflict a never-healing wound? A wound which may make infancy unhappy, adolescence a nightmare? An instrument which may wreck your adult son or daughter's vocational future and their chances for marital happiness.
The idea was we now lived in a very complicated, challenging, cold, impersonal world, and kids better be able to handle that on their own. And if mothers are smothering them with love, this was the period in which the term smother love was first coined, they would be totally ill-equipped.
Mothers just don't know when they kiss their children and pick them up and rock them, caress them and jiggle them upon their knee, that they are slowly building up a human being totally unable to cope with the world it must later live in.
It's all about how parents should above all avoid emotionally coddling their children, the better to free them to interact with their environment and become whatever it is that the kid, in fact, chooses to become.
So in a way, they had to let the child experience their environment unmediated by the parent.
That was the concept. And the interesting thing about Watson is why that actually was what mothers somewhat wanted to hear. Because after all, if you don't have to be constantly at the ready emotionally for your children, you can have a freer and more independent life. And that was something that women in the 20s wanted.
Well, that's fascinating. Inadvertently, you're saying, he provided a pathway towards liberation for women.
I think he did. And it is interesting, the vision of what a modern mother was to be less tied to her children, less emotionally dependent on her children. Her children should be less emotionally dependent on her. All of that, in many ways, I think, said something to women about a new possible role in the world for them.
But what do you think that advice, so-called professional advice to moms in general, has done to the self-confidence of moms in general?
Well, I wish I could say I thought they had achieved their ostensible goal, which has been really ever since the turn of the century, to make mothers and fathers the confident, independent, serene guides of their children that we presume all parents want to be. I think actually, of course, their success has depended on doing something of the opposite, that is kind of making them uneasy enough that they'll always reach for a book.
Or at least the next edition.
Or the next edition. And I guess I would say I'm not actually a believer that we can point the finger at the experts for corroding parental confidence. I think, you know, they're there ministering to something that is somewhat natural, that is, you know, confronted with babies. Parents really often don't know what to do.
Right.
And they are looking for all kinds of counsel. And even if the experts aren't necessarily easing and soothing their predicament, I think we can go a little overboard in accusing them of turning everybody into nervous wrecks. I'm not sure they do that either. I have more respect for parents than that.
Well, let me ask you, I'm just fascinated by these mothering websites. It did strike me that maybe they split the difference between these authoritative experts and lots of moms who simply have a lot of experience under their belt and can really share some of that knowledge with new parents.
You know, I can't claim to be a huge expert on the huge array of, you know, mother-to-mother advice out there on the web. But I have read various books that have emerged from the sort of post-expert culture of we're now going to talk to each other, we're going to be gathering around the village well, you know, which
Starting with the person-to-person defeat of the experts, our bodies, ourselves.
Right. And what to expect when you're expecting. It's written as a dialogue.
Right.
It's, you know, the whole idea is we're talking to each other. And I would say that the surprise to me has been how judgmental the community of mothers itself is and how entrapped some mothers feel by that. There is something actually quite liberating for women in being able to say to male experts, you know, we know a lot better than you do and we're really not going to listen to you.
Yeah.
When suddenly you're hearing it from the woman down the street who insists that if you even consider stopping breastfeeding at 6 months, you are a heretic, it's a little harder to say.
Very interesting.
you're
now part of that is that she's down the street.
Well, it seems to be true even on the internet. You know, she can be, and I think if you dip into some of them, it can be scarier, really.
I really have only one more question, and it did occur to me as I was reading your book. Where are the women experts?
Well, it's a really good question, and I guess I came to think in the course of doing a lot of my research that various women who actually were in the labs doing interesting work had the wisdom to see that they really didn't have enough to go on to inform anything like the kind of dogmatism that it takes to have something that will work as a child.
Right. So women weren't big jerks.
Right. That's it.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
Ann Hulbert is the author of Raising America, Experts, Parents, and a Century of Advice About Children. We'll link to some of her articles about parenthood at backstoryradio.org.
It's time for a short break. When we get back, we'll take more of your calls about the history of motherhood in America.
And while we're gone, here's something to ponder. You know that phrase, as American as motherhood and apple pie? Well, what's so American about apple pie anyway? We can't figure it out, and we'd love to hear your ideas. Drop in at backstoryradio.org and let us know what you think.